Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode 17 of the Driving Eureka podcast. This podcast discusses Doug Hall's newsletter released February 14th. You can get the newsletter at DougHall.com and click newsletter. So our theme this week is integrity, and the feature article in this first segment, Three Ways to Bring Integrity to Your Work. So you picked this theme of integrity. Why integrity?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was Valentine's that this is being released, and I thought there should be integrity in relationships too. No, I mean, really. I mean, it's not that much different. Whether it's in our work or in our relationships, what we're looking for is integrity. That, you know, when I looked it up, And the definition of integrity is the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles, the state of being whole and undivided. I mean, it's kind of as fundamental as that.
So, Doug, when we don't have integrity, what happens?
That's when it gets ugly. Or when it's a movie, it's entertaining, you know, because there's drama and intrigue and politics and all of the stuff going on. And so the opposite of integrity is all of this drama. Mm. And it's drama that sucks the life out of you. And it gets bigger when you're with larger organizations. And the more in organizations, I think, when the leadership or the ownership of the organization is separated from the work of the employees. Because instead of being whole and undivided, we become divided. Our bosses are working off of one mission plan, we're working from a different one. And the net result is there's no integrity. We're disconnected. And so it's just not fun. I mean, it's just not fun.
So is another word for drama than kind of politics then in an organization?
That would definitely be a way that it comes out, where serving myself or my hidden needs, if we're in a passive aggressive mode, is more important than the mutual alignment of us within the organization.
Okay, so this gets now into your three ways to bring integrity to your work, because you just described the getting clarity on the mission. Is there something else you want to say on that?
Yes. Okay. So the three ways are, the first one is clarity of mission. We have to have alignment on a mission that is greater than our individual needs. And this brings integrity to our work. And the key with mission is it's not situationally flexible, you know, where, yes, in the big picture, when we sit in a room, we say, okay, this is our mission. Okay, I understand that's our mission. But in this one case, for this one project or customer or client, we're not going to follow that mission. No, that's not integrity. Mm. It's not situationally flexible. That's not what I mean by it. It transcends our daily work. It provides a purpose across days, weeks, and months. And when we do this at the ranch, we call this strategy activation, or blue cards, which comes out of the military, commander's intent, that we've talked about. It's about a sense of purpose so that we know why we're there and what we're doing. When you have that, that is the foundation, the bedrock that gives clarity to our mission, our life, and frankly, our relationship.
So one of the things you just said in there, and it just kind of pops out at me, and I think it's worth repeating, is that all organizations have some type of mission associated with what they're trying to accomplish. And it may have been made 50 years earlier. And somehow that alignment gets, I don't know, I think it ages over time, and people just, you know, start moving away from what it was, or maybe it wasn't valid in the first place. So the alignment portion of this is, I think, is really important for listeners to gather, is that we're being consistent, and that therefore brings integrity to the mission. Is that
I think so. I think though, if we look at a lot of those old ones, mm-hmm. those missions are more like you're running for Miss Universe, you know, save the world and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Nobody cares. No, I'm talking about the mission of what we're doing right now, how we are organized to win. What's the difference we're going to make in the world? What is the thing we've brought together as an org group to accomplish something greater than ourselves? What is it that we're trying to accomplish? And it shouldn't be 700 years into the future or 100 years from the past, because the world's changed. There's much more of a sense of, you know, when we say strategy activation, it's about what is activating us to get going right now.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that's actually a better explanation than what I would have thought, you know, going into my head about what strategy activation meant. Sounds like, you know, something that you're getting ready to do, as opposed to the operational definition you just gave. So that makes sense. So what about data-driven decisions, the second one?
Yeah, so with the foundation in place of the mission, we then need to know, are we getting closer to it or further away? And the only way to figure that out is with data. The nice thing about data is there's no emotional drama connected to it. Now, I'm not saying that it's all black and white. In fact, high-quality data has variation in it. There's probabilities. But data gives us clarity, and it takes out drama, takes out politics, and it keeps us objective, which is why, frankly, I love the Deming cycle of plan, do, study, act. And the most important step of that being, you know, the plan, what are we trying to get to, do, what's our hypothesis, what are we doing, and then study, did the action accomplish the aim of what we were trying to do? And in the bigger picture, it's, does this help us accomplish our mission or not? I mean, it's as simple as that. Not my opinion on it, but quantitatively, does the data give us confidence that by doing this action, we're going to see a positive movement towards the mission of what we're trying to do? And now I know, as I'm saying this, I can read the thought balloons as you're driving in your car, as you're exercising, or wherever you're listening to this podcast. Your thought balloon goes, yeah, I understand. That's fine, because you sell whiskey and that's like a product, but I'm in the service business. I'm in the industrial business. I'm in the blah, blah, blah. I'm in a nonprofit. We just had a whole bunch of schools with colleges with us. I'm in the education business. There just isn't data for what I have to do. Well, get over yourself. The fact of the matter is if we can measure creativity, groups of people creating ideas as ethereal as ideas, then you can measure everything. And in fact, you know, our course, our innovation engineering courses that the Eureka Ranch teaches, as well as our services that we provide, you know, we call it test the untestable, just to challenge people, mm-hmm. as we talked about just recently, because you can measure anything. You can measure anything. I challenge you. I absolutely challenge you. If you don't think you can measure it, contact me at the Eureka Ranch, and I guarantee you, I'll put up a bottle of my best whiskey against your favorite whiskey that I can measure and provide data to help with your decisions on anything that you've got. Just straight up, my best whiskey against yours. I'll do it. Because when we have data, we're now taking out that human emotional bias that comes. Hmm. I mean, in one example, we have a system called Truth Teller that quantifies innovations, whether they be services, products, whatever they might be. And literally, we took a bunch of ideas that leadership had said of top corporations, Fortune 100, had said, go do them. And then we asked the truth teller system to evaluate the ideas, not knowing if they'd succeeded or not, and to say, you know, would you have said go or no? And it was 7 times smarter than humans at making decisions. Not that humans are stupid, but we got all this emotional baggage. And when that emotional baggage is playing, then we lose integrity of our work, and it just becomes demoralizing because we make dumb decisions.
Yeah, there's one thing I think it's important to kind of say with regards to data-driven decisions, and it's kind of covertly in there, but what you're measuring is associated with something that creates value for customers. It's kind of the underlying thing.
Well, that's one part.
Yeah,
that's only one part.
That's a good part.
Yeah, it's an important part. Yes, it's an important part. But it's not just that. It's also about the likelihood that we would be able to. And again, it's a value, but it's in a very broad definition. Will a student learn from this? Will employees be more effective at this? Will they be more efficient? It's any change that we're about to do. It's getting data to guide us to make the right decision to go or not on any change that we're implementing in our professional life.
Okay, so the truth teller system is much broader than just getting the information from whether a customer likes your product or service or not, is what you're saying.
It actually doesn't involve, ready for this? It doesn't involve testing with customers. It's a benchmarking system against 50 traits that we found that are predictive of success for change. And it was validated by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And so it's much broader than just, you know, how likely are you to buy something? That's not really what it's about. It's about a broader dimension, which is, do you have the kind of traits that predict success with an important change?
Okay, now that's a little esoteric, and I may be getting into kind of the company secrets, but can you name a couple of the 50?
Clarity.
Okay.
You know, confusion is not predictive of success.
All right, that's fair.
Yeah. So clarity is one of those things. We also know, in fact, in the Driving Eureka book, I talk about a number of these things.
Okay.
Focus is important. You know, if you're trying to do three things, it's not as good as trying to do one thing. We joke focus, that when you have, clarity and focus on doing one thing great, you're more likely to be successful than if you're trying to do three things at the same time. I mean, I guess it's the science of common sense.
Okay.
A little bit more involved in that with 50 traits, but it's pretty clear. We have the technology to do this. You know, many people, when they work at organizations, they think, well, we can't measure that. And because 20 years ago, you couldn't. But you know, these computer things, they're pretty amazing. And our ability to do simulations, to model uncertainty, is amazing on what we can do today.
Yeah, and I think in episode 15, you also talked about, you know, at the beginning, there's more uncertainty. So there's going to be a broader range of, if we're trying to guess what the sales of a particular product is, that it's going to be broad. But as you refine and looking at the data and learning more as you move through PDSA, then you're really starting to narrow in on how big that market is associated with that product or service.
Yeah, but now, okay, so that, yes.
Okay.
For the idea.
Mm-hmm.
However, the bigger use of that is as you're in development, and this is a really important point, because people think, well, we're just trying to decide if the idea is right or to do or not. Well, the reality of it is that's not what you're doing in development. I mean, you know, assume you've done the idea is good enough. The problem is that when you try to do the idea, whether it's a new course, whether it's a new fundraising thing or a new product or whatever it might be, a new system, is as you start to try to do the work to develop it, you find that it just doesn't work the way you thought it did. You try to put the things together and there's just things that you can't program. There's things that as you try to put the class together, it just doesn't fit in the time that's allowed. Or there's rules and regulations that, you know, that say that, you know, you can't have students, you know, going crazy in the classroom. Mm. You know, there's something that comes up that causes you to have to adapt the idea. And so the primary thing you're doing with data is making sure that when you get to those forks in the road and you have hundreds of them, hundreds of them that occur, that you're making the right decision, or you're deciding, you know something, we're dead. Forget it. Now, that's rare. The majority of the time what happens is you have to pivot. You have to change the idea. You have to adapt it. You have to do it. That's the unknown that people think. Everybody's got this idea that you get this big idea and then you just do it. That's not where 98% of the problem is. The problem is in development, not the idea. Mm-hmm. It's you know, we, because what happens is we make a little change and a little change, and we compromise a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, until, you know, the idea is like, whatever, it's not worth doing anymore.
Okay. So you have two of the three things we covered: the clarity of the mission, data-driven decisions, and the third one you put is culture of innovation. What do you mean by that?
Well, integrity requires a mindset that is open to confronting uncomfortable realities. I mean, part of integrity is calling people out when something's not right, or calling it out when we're about to make the wrong thing. And as a lone wolf in an organization, you can do it for a while until eventually you just get burnt out and exhausted. It's much easier to do this when you're working within a culture that embraces innovation. And a culture of innovation embraces change, learning, experimentation. I mean, when you hit those death threats, those problems, they're seen as opportunities for fresh thinking as opposed to being something to be suppressed or blamed on someone. And so it's a matter of creating a community around you that has a common sense of mission, a common commitment to data. If you're spending half your time debating whether or not we should have data, then you're just dead. And so if you want to have integrity, to sustain integrity, you've got to create that culture of like-minded people around you. And frankly, that's the mission of my entire life. When I step back and look at the whole thing, it's about helping people create, whether it's opening up their minds to ideas, whether it's the Driving Eureka book and helping you take those ideas to reality, whether it's my books, the TV shows, this podcast. It's about how do we bring people together so that they can win. And you need that culture to give you the energy source to keep going when you run into the inevitable challenges that you're going to face when you're trying to do something amazing.
It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. Okay. Well, let's move to our second segment here, which is the Driving Eureka book segment. And you really kind of dive into one of Dr. Deming's famous line of about pride in work. So whatever happened to pride of work associated with that? Was Deming the inspiration for this, or was it something else?
Yeah, the phrase obviously came from Deming. It was this section from Driving Eureka talks about pride of work. And it's interesting because crossing over with me doing the work in the craft whiskey space, it's been an interesting learning because when it comes to craft products, and I don't care if you're talking craft food, craft restaurant, craft whiskey, craft beer, craft hats, craft clothing, whatever it is, you know, there is a definite movement around the world right now for this craft thing. I mean, you see it when I travel in other countries, the same thing, where there's a difference between, you know, the mass market stuff and the thing that separates them, I think, craft companies from mass market companies, is this pride of work. That there is a sense of pride in the thing that we're doing. In other words, as part of the mission, you know, it's often commonly said that if you work for a large publicly traded company, your mission, it is said, I'm not condoning it, I'm just reporting it, that your mission is to help the shareholders make more money. That is your purpose. Your purpose is to help the shareholders. And if it'll help the shareholders make more money and the shareholders do it, then that's why you're there. You are there to serve the shareholders. That's your mission. Well, that's fine. And if that's your deal, that's cool. I got that. With craft companies, there is a higher calling. Money is the outcome of the mission. It's not the mission. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In one case, they say, we're going to make more money and we're going to do it by doing this. In the other case, we flip it over. And our mission is to make the world's greatest grilled cheese sandwiches for people. And if we do that, we'll make money. It's an inversion of the mindset. And I think at its root, that's what it's about. And it's about doing things that may not always be, you know, visible to people. It's about caring. When you peel back a craft company, you are pleasantly surprised by what you see. When you peel back a mass market company, you're oftentimes shocked at what you see. I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, this is an old guy who's been doing this for a long time. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I think the one thing that, you know, if I'm an executive in a large company, which I've been before, you know, one of the things that happens is that, yes, you are focused on the financials. You're focused on what you said, which is you're looking at the quarterly dividend. And so I almost hear, and I don't think you mean this, but what I hear is, well, if you're one of those, our system won't work for you. In other words, because we're focused on trying to make a better product that's going to produce that outcome. And I think I just want to talk a little bit more, or have you talk a little bit more about method versus outcome. So in other words, if you know, there's the big thing with executives. I mean, they're focused on their financials. They're focused on their sales pipeline. They're focused.
Okay, whereas, so let's just go back. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's just go back to integrity.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I went to work for Procter & Gamble because Procter & Gamble's commitment was to do the right thing in the right way. And if it was going to cost the company money, they would do it anyways if it was the right thing to do. Okay, so the question is when the drama comes, are you more loyal to making money or to doing the right thing in the right way? That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And no, I'm not going to give any room for the money changers. I'm not going to give it. I'm not going to give it. No, you have to have a mission. Money is an outcome. It's not the mission. It cannot be the mission. If it's the mission, you will fail because you will not do the right things in the right way for the long-term success of the organization. It is an outcome. Nobody goes to buy your products. Let's think of it this way. Well, our mission is to make more money for the shareholders. Hi, would you please buy my new soft drink? It will make me more money. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
I mean, it's there is zero tolerance in my head for this. Now, that's not to say that they aren't that way, and that's not to say they aren't precious. I got all of that. I'm good with all of that. But that cannot be the mission of the organization. You're not going to get great employees. You're not going to do great stuff. And it's just a matter of time before you die or get bought. Same thing. Now, we've got to have a mission that is greater than that. And to get that pride of work, it means we've got to have a commitment to that. And you can see it in organizations. You can see it when they're committed to educating their employees versus treating them as replaceable parts. You can see it when you have leadership setting long-term strategic vision and saying, this is where we're going to go, and we're going to invest in this to make this work, and we're willing to take time versus the shortest, you know, distance we can get to make in the next buck so that I can get my next bonus. And I know this is hard. That's why it's called integrity. Integrity. This is the difference between people with integrity and not. And I know that is brutal, and I'm going to get slammed from people on this. Well, you don't understand. My life is miserable. Well, then change it. You have to start from yourself and say, I'm going to do stuff that matters. And you know what? I'm not talking the easy path. No, I'm not talking the easy path. But the path of integrity is not easy. It's about making those choices of what you're going to do. And when you have that pride of work, you know, I wrote in the newsletter of Steve Jobs told the story of from his adopted father. He told Walter Isaacson about it. He said, Once Walter Isaacson wrote, he said, once they were looking at a fence, this is Steve Jobs and his adopted dad, and he said, his dad said, you got to make the back of the fence that nobody will see just as good looking as the front of the fence. Even though nobody will see it, you will know, and that will show that you're dedicated to making something perfect.
That's a good quote.
I mean, that's called integrity.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's integrity. It may look fine, but when you open the drawers, are they stapled together or have they been fitted together of the desk? And if I have something to throw at, I mean, I love design. I love great design. You've been to the ranch. You've seen we have a lot of great design. I love design. But I love design like the furniture we have there, which is Stickley furniture made in upstate New York, which is incredible old furniture made with dovetails and with true oak and real integrity to it. It's not just a pretty couch. It's a phenomenal couch. That's integrity. And that's the craft world, is that we put integrity in our product. And that's where, you know, that's where the future is going to go. And the reason it's different today is because of this thing called the internet. Because when you don't have integrity, the world's going to find out. So the debate between integrity or not, the good news is the internet, over time, truth will become more truthful, and those without integrity will die.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Bringing integrity to the craft whiskey business. Now, you've touched upon it a little bit in our conversation so far. How are you bringing integrity to craft whiskey?
Well, I'm gonna first off confront this issue. I'm going to confront the issue as to what is integrity in a craft spirit, because there's a lot of debate. There's a lot of debate amongst the craft world, especially in the spirits world, as to what is a true craft product. In other words, they're debating. Some organizations have certified craft product, craft, you know, all these things. And what is craft? And there's a number of options. I mean, one option is that it's a proprietor or a proprietorship that it's majority controlled, some say 75, some say 80%, controlled by an individual or individuals working in the business, not by some mega corporation. So craft is basically employee-owned kind of thing. Another one is small volume. If you're tiny, in the whiskey business, they call it under 100,000 proof gallons is a definition that's oftentimes used. So you're small volume. Mm-hmm. Another is one location. So you distill, age, and blend in one location. This is the way Scotland defines single malt, is that it's made at one spot. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then the most extreme example, a friend of mine does, which is farm to glass, where he grows the grain, distills, ages, and blends all on one location. Now, that's an extreme one. I guess he could go even more extreme, and he could make his own electricity too. You know, so you can see there's a number of different places you could define it. And where you could define what is a true craft company, a true crafts whiskey company.
Okay, but you've missed one in here, and you and I had a conversation about this, and maybe you see it fitting in one of these, but you know, I shared a conversation that I had online with someone. They said, "Oh no, you know, what type of stuff is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy putting together, because it's not aged, you know, in the traditional sense. It's being built there." And you shared a conversation that you had also in Cincinnati. Does that fit into, I mean, from that person's perspective, that's an integrity issue, you know?
Yep.
You've got to age that. You know, it's got to be in barrels for 15 years or 24 years or whatever.
And again, I mean, and that's that kind of one location or old style approach.
Okay.
And that's fine. And that's fine. That could be a definition too. You know, it really, so we've got these challenges on how we're going to define it. And so how do you do it? Well, my view is that craft comes from a person, not a corporation at its most basic. It's about having someone of someone's who are connected directly to the work. Corporations can't be craft. I mean, saying corporations with quotes around it. Only people can craft. So that means there's a person. Now, in the old days of Johnny Walker, Jimmy Beam, and Jack Daniels, there was that. There isn't anymore. They're owned by mega corporations now. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so when they were there, it was craft. Today, it's not. I mean, that's just my simplistic definition. To be craft, somebody has to be doing the crafting. Okay?
Okay.
The second thing is there's a commitment to create products that are meaningfully unique, as we've talked about.
Yep.
In other words, good enough is not craft. It's about having caring and pride in the product. And oftentimes, it's about you develop a house style. And if you don't like my product, that's okay. But this is what I'm doing. In other words, you've made a statement. You haven't tried to be all things to all people. You've made a choice that says, this is what I believe to the world matters. And so this is what I do. In our case, we really like to have complexity, but clean. In other words, we try to, as I've talked before, we try to have the complexity of a whiskey from the old country with the cleanness of new world bourbons. In other words, so it's complex, but clean. That's our house style. That's what I like. That's what we make. And if you don't like that, I'm cool with that. But I'll respect yours. You just respect that's my style. That's my house style that I like. That's what we try to do. And we'll do collaborations with people that are different. But on our fundamental products that we put out under our name, that's what you're going to see in every one of our products, or else we're not doing it. Okay. So there is this, there are some lines about what you're going to be. And then it's also, lastly, it's about honesty and transparency about what you do and don't do. Okay. And so if, are you going to grow your grain? That's cool. Are you not going to grow your grain? Are you going to buy it from, you know, on the open market from conglomerates? Fine. Are you going to buy it from family farms? Fine. You know, whatever your choices are your choices. Don't try to lie that you're doing something else. Just be open about it. Okay. We can't do it all. We can't make our electricity, grow our grain, make our own fertilizer, you know, and do the whole thing. So we're going to pick a place that we're going to apply our craft. You know, the person who makes, you know, furniture might specialize in a certain type of furniture. One person focuses maybe on the finish or the woods that are selected. Another one, the intricacy of the cuts. Everybody's different. Okay. I respect them all. Same way with whiskey. I respect what you're doing, however you choose to do it. If you want to age it for, and you have a lot of money and you're able to age it for a long time, awesome. I think that's great. We don't have that kind of money to go do that. And it's tough. But if you do, great. That's great. As long as you're making a great product that you're proud of, not just something that's good enough to sell. That is not craft. That's not craft. Now, in the case of Brain Brew Custom Whiskey, I've decided to focus on the interaction of the wood and the spirit. That's what we've gone deep on. Okay. So a friend of mine in Cincinnati buys grain from farms, family farms, and distills it. That's awesome. A friend in Nova Scotia actually grows the grain himself and then distills it. That's awesome for him. In my case, my background, 20-something years in this industry, is that 70% of the flavor comes from the wood, okay? And so that's where I focus. 25% is grain selection, 5% is on distilling. Some people want to go focused on distilling. Some people want to do grains. I want to do wood, okay? So I buy my spirit because I don't want to waste my energy on that. I want to spend all of my time on making that whiskey taste as smooth and as complex yet clean as I possibly can. And so that's what I do. And I don't use, we have rules. We don't use chemicals. We don't use colors. We don't put in flavors. We do it. We do classic process, same process, just replicating seasons of barrel aging by using heat and cooling to do it. So that's my choice as a craft. And I'm very open about that. We don't hide anything. We're very honest with it. Now, if at the end of the day, you don't like that because you want to have something that's been aged for 10 years, that's cool. That's cool. But I've made my choices. of what I want to spend my time crafting.
Okay, that's fair. You know, it's interesting as we talk here about the whiskey, and we've had conversations about this before, you know, that Cincinnati had lots of distilleries at one point. And it seems like we used to be this, you know, you almost have this vision of the blacksmith, the person who make things and craft their own metal and things of that sort. And then we went through this industrial revolution where we kind of brought everything together to make more of it faster and cheaper. And now there seems to be this kind of trend to this kind of craft because people can do it and do it, you know, associated because of technology or whatever, to be able to kind of separate it out into a making craft not only, you know, competitive, but also tasty in the case of whiskey.
Well, that's right. There's more, you can be more regional. I can take, you know, the oak from Manitoba, mm-hmm. and I can make a whiskey with that oak so they can taste it, as opposed to getting the same wood as everybody else. I mean, we're in a world where that diversity is celebrated. But you're absolutely right. We went from a time when, you know, I mean, Cincinnati was the heart of whiskey making on the planet. More whiskey was made in Cincinnati, plus the areas of, you know, the people in Cincinnati owned many of the distilleries in Kentucky because it was the big commercial center. And collectively, it was the heart of whiskey making on the planet. And this is really, the volumes they were doing was just ridiculous. 70 distilleries or rectifiers. And now many of these people were blenders. They would buy whiskey and put it together. That's an artistry to put together. I learned recently, you know, we've talked before, Tripp, about distillers versus whiskey makers. The whiskey maker takes the different barrels and puts it together. Whiskey makers are paid 65% more money than distillers are.
Wow. Yeah.
So that gives you some sense how important the whiskey maker is versus the distiller. Now, that's not just this distiller is important. We have to do it. But that's not where the value add comes. The value add comes in putting those barrels together in different ways. Now, to be fair, in Cincinnati, its history is not all positive. You know, pre-prohibition and following prohibition, there were some things that were done where people would throw stuff into the spirit, the young spirit, to make it drinkable that was not always good for people. In fact, it was very bad for people.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And it's the same way the food industry. I mean, what big food did is it made food safer because there would be people growing food that was not necessarily pure and right. So it's not all just, oh, isn't that nice to have that quaint organic farm? It has to be done with food safety and done properly. The difference is, and so a lot of those things went away because the cost and quality was better with manufactured. Now, with new technologies and we know more, it is now possible again for us to have craft that's giving us quality and value and not be the lowest common denominator. So this is a resurgent that is growing. It's only going to get bigger as time goes on. And it'll be interesting because I, you know, we work with a lot of big corporations and don't get me wrong. You know, we love big corporations and we love the people in particular within them, the people, because there are good people in these organizations looking to bring more craft spirit, bring more caring in it. And many leaders are supportive of it, but sadly there are still too many that are not. And, I'm optimistic, though. I mean, it's going to change. It's going to change, and we're going to see more of a openness to having integrity.
Well, it's cool to see that you're part of that change. From my perspective, just kind of watching, you know, some of the things you patented, you know, the way you're going about the wood, those types of things, you're bringing change to the industry by virtue of doing these types of things.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. Well, let's move to the craft cocktail recipe. And it looks like you have a Brain Brewer original here, the Island Sailor. You got to tell me about the name first.
The name is named after my beloved Prince Edward Island. As you know, I have Canadian and U.S. citizenship, and we have a home in Springbrook, Prince Edward Island on the shore of New London Bay. And we have a Brain Brew Beach Bar we set up every summer down there. And so while we were up there playing and messing around, I said, well, we got to celebrate the sailors and the farmers. I have an island farmer as well. We're equal opportunity here. So this is designed to take you to the sand, sun, and sea. And it's perfect when you're looking to escape the winter blast. So here we are, middle of February. You got your sweetheart. It's Valentine's Day. This podcast comes out. Time to just kind of chill out, maybe put some island music on and enjoy it.
I guess at the moment, I'm sitting here thinking February 14th in New England on a beach. That's a big overcoat on and making this drink or something. Well, I think I'd rather be in Florida or someplace. I don't know.
Take your mind to that spot.
Okay.
So the way it works is this. Take a Boston shaker. You remember what that is, right?
Oh, yes. I've got that drummed into my head. Not a cobbler shaker. And now I remember. Now I had to look up the name of what the other one's called. They call it a cobbler, apparently.
That's right. A Boston shaker is the one where you have generally a glass and then a metal tube about the same size so that you get a good throw with it. Fill it with ice. 1.5 ounces of our Relativity. 1/2 ounce of sweet vermouth. 1/2 ounce of grenadine. And 1/2 ounce of fresh orange juice. Give it a shake. Let's put it in a martini glass. You could do a rocks glass. In fact, you could do the whole thing just on the rocks. But let's add some elegance to it. So we're going to shake it, put it in a martini glass, and then a splash of 7-Up, regular or diet, doesn't matter, whatever's your taste preference. And if you're really going crazy, some champagne or sparkling wine will take it even over the top, even more. But it's just some bubbly, lots of fruit, lots of character to it. The whiskey gives it some depth and a backbone to it. So it's not a sugary drink. Think of this as tiki done less sweet, more cocktail-like, instead of sort of the tiki sugar drinks that we've tended to get to as time's gone on.
Right.
And it's just kind of a fun, lighthearted, little bit of maybe some steel drum music to help you escape to the islands, wherever that is.
So one thing I do want to cover off in these, just because, I've gone to mixing these, actually, even at the Super Bowl, I wound up doing the bourbon milk punch.
What do you think of that?
We did in episode 15. No, it was well-liked, but especially by people who, like you said, don't drink whiskey. But the one thing I have trouble with is because, for instance, Relativity isn't in my area, what would you recommend as, other, because I know you're favored towards the craft industry.
Yeah.
What would be an equivalent to a Relativity?
So I would strongly, strongly, strongly recommend that you explore the craft spirit scene in your community. And go to your local liquor store, or actually just go to the local bars and just say who's got the best craft spirits whiskeys. They know the world, and so I would really suggest that you do that. Now, if you're stuck in the middle of nowhere where there's no great craft spirit, and certain areas of the country, the Northwest, different places are really rich in it. There are some barren parts of the planet where we haven't gotten there yet. And if you're really forced to do it, then if you're making cocktails, bourbon and rye is kind of the simple go-to, and if you'll see it in bars, you'll see it on the menus oftentimes. If you want it more whiskey forward, use the rye. If you want it less so, use the bourbon. But, and it's made by, big-ass company, but it's not craft. But it's a good, solid, reliable, practical, prudent product.
Nice.
I'm saying this nicely. I've worked with them before.
Okay.
So I know them. And they're good folks. They're good folks. And it is a good, solid product for value for the money. If you're stuck with it, then try that.
Okay. But is Relativity then, which grain is that?
That's a 4-grain product. That's the most... one of the most inventive products. I created that product with a friend, John, and somebody had to do it, 2 weeks of tasting to put it together. But we literally use wheat, corn, rye, and barley, all four grains in it. So it's okay. Not a bourbon. It's not a scotch. It's a whiskey. It's an American whiskey. We call it the new American whiskey. And it literally takes all four grains. And think of them as four notes that make up a chord that you might play on a piano.
Okay.
And we've made the four grains come together. There's some nice wheat in there that gives it an elegance to it. Truly elegance. I mean, the big fancy bourbons are all wheat forward. It gives an elegance to it. The corn gives it some mouthfeel and a touch of sweetness. The rye gives it just a touch of spice. The way we do the rye, it's not as spicy as it is richness. I think our rye gives richness more than spice. And then there's just a little bit of barley, which is kind of like the base note. It just balances it out and gives it a base note to it. So
okay.
You got the wheat at the top, the corn, and then it's almost like in order. Wheat, corn, rye, barley, from the very lightest, sort of the high notes, down through to the bass notes, and a lot of the soprano, a lot of the wheat in it, but which is very difficult to work with well. I mean, to make it really work for you, it takes a lot of work. We spend a lot of time with how we work the wood with the wheat in particular.
Okay, so long explanation there, but it sounds like there really isn't an equivalent then to the Relativity product because it's kind of its own category.
Well, let's go back a second. I think okay. Earlier on this segment, I think I talked about a commitment to create products that are meaningfully unique.
Well, start getting your product where I am. Get your product where I am then. I must be in one of those barren places that you were talking about.
Noble Oak will be everywhere soon, and Relativity will have it at the ranch and here in Ohio, and then maybe we'll work to get it over to Indiana soon.
Okay, very good. All right, well, that concludes our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Any final comments, Doug?
Yeah, so the whole subject of this podcast is around this concept of integrity, and it's not time to rant about it. It's not time to complain about it. It's not time to whine about it. Integrity comes from when we make a decision that we're going to live a life with integrity. And I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's always the most popular thing to do. But you know what integrity is when you look within yourself and you say, that's what I got to do. That's the right thing. And the good news is there's people to help. We've got a wonderful community of folks that we're teaching, and there's a community growing up around the world, some 35,000 strong now, which are focused on doing the right things in the right way. So thank you very much, folks.
Is it time to use artificial intelligence and innovation forecasting? We believe the answer is yes. The Truth Teller system shows evidence of picking winning innovations 7 times better than executives in thousands of research tests. Be sure to look at our show notes for this episode to download more about the Truth Teller system, or use go.drivingeureka.com/truthteller. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.